Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 131 of Registry Matters. Larry, 131 episodes. I can't really quite believe it, to be honest with you.
I can't either. We're just beginning.
We are? We got more to go?
We haven't even reached adolescence yet.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess by your standards, 131 is probably just like about to hit puberty, isn't it?
Not even close. We're still in elementary school.
We're still wearing diapers?
We're in elementary school.
We have a very special guest joining us tonight. We tried to get him last week, but apparently there was some unrest going on in Minnesota. And so we have joining us a Christian from Minnesota 4, which I right off the bat have to ask, what is Minnesota 4?
Sure, no problem. Guys, you know, living in Minnesota and going through the struggles that we face every day, I've been seeing things from NARSOL, like Nebraska, the Fearless Group, and some other groups. And I kind of approached Brenda, talked to Brenda, and there was a contact named Tim. With him, we created Minnesota 4. And at that point, I kind of reached out to some churches to say, hey, this is what we're about. There was a church, a Methodist church, that gladly took this on. And in fact, they want this to spread around the Methodist churches in Wisconsin and Minnesota. So a little struggle kind of taking off, but it's getting there, about 12 members right now. So Minnesota stands for Minnesota for Our Rights.
Oh, I understand. I understand. I was like, F-O-U-R, number four? I have not been able to figure out what Minnesota 4 is, but now I understand. Welcome, welcome.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
Do you want to jump right in, Larry, or do you want to give us any words of wisdom before we dive in?
I think we're going to jump in because we've got a full house of guests, and we've got so many articles, and we've got a tight time schedule because I have an appointment.
Very good. Before we even get going, like, holy cow, we have a whole bunch of people in live stream, like, listening to us record this. So that is pretty awesome. Like, you know, we joke that, you know, it's thousands of listeners, but tonight it's a really good number.
Yeah. And my fiance is even here tonight.
I don't know that she has agreed that that is the case.
That is good news to hear, Larry. Wow.
Yeah. Especially since she has a husband.
Oh,
I don't discriminate on things like that.
I Larry always pictured you with two cats and living in a duplex, so I'm sorry. I'm kidding.
Yeah, I know, right? Well, let's get things rolling. The first thing that we have is, and I think this came out right as we were recording last week, and just didn't quite grab it in time, but this was it's from Texas Voices, and it's court cases Hearn versus Castillo. Deheya, I don't even know how to pronounce that word, but it's an unfavorable decision in the Hearn case. And I got through about two paragraphs and my eyes roll in the back of my head, and I'm hoping that Larry can digest this for us a little bit.
Sure, I'll try. So this case was in the United States District Court, and we talk a lot about district court cases because in the level of federal courts, that's the trial court of general subject matter jurisdiction. Just FYI, you also have another court in the federal system that is a part of the judiciary called the magistrate court, the magistrate judges, and the magistrate judges play a part in initial proceedings and certain parts of civil litigation are done by the magistrate. But this is a trial level court. This case was taken to trial rather than summary judgment. And it was relatively a narrow focus case on the registry violates the plea agreement. And so what Richard Gladden, who's been a long time a supporter of Texas Voices and has been even on NARSOL calls, and I think he's, I don't know if he has attended a conference. Yes, he has. But anyway, he's been an activist for a long time, civil rights attorney, and he brought this case. And the theory was that those who received deferred adjudications at one time in Texas did not have to register. They were not a covered offender. And an example, like in New Mexico, we have a conditional discharge. If you receive that, that's an exemption from registration. Texas removed that registration. and then that exemption, and require those people to register. And then Texas changed the law to require the people to register for life. And so the litigation was challenging that the plea agreements that people pled thinking they were going to either not have to register, or the other argument is, which wasn't in this case, that I would have to register for a shorter period of time. The biggest flaw in that logic is you have to prove the registry is punitive before you're subject to that type. If the plea agreement, if they change something that's not punishment, which as far as I know, there's been no decision in the state of Texas that says the registry is punitive. I know about Doe's versus Snyder. We could go through a whole list of cases, but that's not Texas. And the Texas registry has not risen to the level of punishment as far as what has been proven in courts. So therefore, the litigation was not successful. The state put forth a bunch of specious arguments that they always do. They said that the department is not a party to the plea agreements, therefore it's not the proper party to be sued. That's on page 4. They said there's not a substantive due process right to be free from ongoing registration. They said that a writ of habeas corpus was the right way to bring this rather than a 1983. And they said the statute of limitations on the claims that the people had run, because since 1983 doesn't have a particular statute of limitations in that section of law, the federal courts defer to what the statute of limitations are in the state where you're bringing the action. And they said that the state argued the statute of limitations had run. And then they said that the claims are barred by a doctrine articulated in Heck versus Humphrey. And I always thought it was Humphrey versus Heck. But anyway, I've heard that case before. And they lost their case. I don't know if Richard plans to do an appeal, but the case law in the Fifth Circuit, which Texas is in, is not good.
And so statute of limitations, and how are these situations similar to other places where they have ruled them to be unconstitutional?
Well, not having a lot of knowledge about the Texas registration, I don't know if the disabilities, for example, are comparable to what's in Michigan or in Pennsylvania, be that as it may, even if they are, that wasn't one of their claims. They didn't raise that as a claim. Their theory was that since the plea agreements at the time didn't require registration, that this is changing the plea agreement. So they were proceeding under that the state of Texas should be required and held that contract, and plea agreements are considered a contract, and the court does say that here, but the court says that it's merely a regulation. It's not anything to do with changing their punishment, so therefore they haven't changed the plea agreement.
And true, and I wanted to jump in here, guys. Mr. Gladden had had the theory of a previous Supreme Court case of Santabella versus New York, which they changed his plea agreement and went all the way to the Supreme Court, and I think it was a 5-4 decision. So with that theory, Mr. Gladden thought that surely would violate the 14th Amendment and the contract clause. So, but unfortunately, I don't think the judge fully read the briefs or cut it short or something like that, you know.
Larry?
Yeah, I was making sure he was finished. But yeah, I'm not knocking. Everybody can look at the decision and say what they would have done. I don't know whether I would have brought this claim or not. I wasn't faced with this particular person. But anybody who did come to me wanting to bring this, I would tell them that until we can prove that our registry is punitive, that it's going to be a long shot. And I know people don't like to hear that, but if you haven't met the threshold of showing the registry imposes punishment, you're going to have a hard time getting to where you want to go, because you're allowed to do a lot of things as long as you're not altering the punishment.
Christian, any replies?
Yeah, absolutely. I would like to say that I'm hoping that the Fifth Circuit, of course, overrules that. And Larry, you're right. I read that and reading Texas Voices on their page that, Larry, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was a 2012 or 2017 Supreme Court decision or Fifth Circuit that they had already ruled for one of the reasons. And I think that Mr. Gladden expects once this to get to the Fifth Circuit that they're going to overrule the judge. And I think that we may be 50% there. It could be the reasoning behind that. But I do want to share with you another thing really quick. There was another case in Texas that just previously was won. It was CI versus McGraw. Sort of the similar case. The guy was on deferred. In this case, he got off in 1996, but they didn't really come looking for him until I think about 2012 or 13 and said, hey, you got to do this. He did take it to court, and he did win in the district court. But there was just only one gentleman, but he didn't claim the 14th. He didn't have those constitutional claims as Mr. Gladden did. So but that was a win, but I don't know how far that's going to go in the state court in Texas. So.
Well, Christian, how is he going to overcome the unpublished opinion? Now, unpublished opinions are not binding. They're merely persuasive. It's kind of like when you have an out-of-circuit opinion, when you start citing the Sixth Circuit when you're in the 11th or the 5th, it's not binding. But when he takes this up on appeal, how is he going to overcome the unpublished opinions? And if you look on page 7, it says what I think is going to be difficult to overcome, that the Fifth Circuit stated in unpublished opinions, this court has repeatedly affirmed district court's dismissal as frivolous to claim that the retroactive application of Texas law requiring sex offender registration and notifications violates the ex post facto clause. So I'm just wondering how he's going to get around, because what you're going to have happen is you're going to have three judge panel that's going to say, well, we're not bound by this, and we're going to completely disregard the previous analyses that's been done.
Well, so what do you think, Christian?
Can you guys hear me?
What are they going to? Yeah, we can hear you.
One second here.
Christian?
Just a second here, guys. Oh, can you hear me, guys?
Yes.
I don't think he's hearing us.
Okay. Sorry about that. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hear me okay?
We keep saying yes, we're hearing you, but you're not responding to us.
Yes. Oh, I guess you can't hear me. I'm mute. It's under mute. Okay, sorry. I do see what you're saying, Larry. I think you're right. It wasn't published. I just got through Mr. Gladden, just had another court case. Interesting enough, this was a very interesting case, I thought. He's handling a guy in the federal court, same judge, by the way. Richard Gladden brought the CI versus McGraw case up in court recently, and of course, being not published. You're right. I don't know a lot about the published versus non-published, and I thought that was always interesting enough to kind of gather more information about.
Well, the non-published are not binding, but like I say, you would use it as the same way we would use an out-of-circuit decision. You would say that when the panel picks up this case, if he takes it up on appeal, they know that it's not binding, but they're going to look at the quality of the analysis in it, and if nothing has been changed and distinguished from that analysis, they would have to be a renegade panel to say we're going to disregard the previous analysis, even though it is not binding on them. So that's what I'm wondering, how he's going to find two of three that are going to say to heck with what the previous panel has decided, because it is not binding on them because it's not published.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that may be a tough battle to win, for sure. I hope that Mr. Gladden prevails in the Fifth Circuit.
We certainly all do hope that, but I believe in telling people to my detriment that I think that he's going against the odds on this. Now he's got another step. He can file a cert petition with the Supreme Court, which I don't know if he did in the Louisville. Did he seek the U.S. Supreme Court review in the City of Louisville case with the residence restrictions?
Yes, he did.
And they said no.
So now here's another thought. If Larry and Andy, if the Supreme Court had made a decision in 1971 and Santabella versus New York, do you think that could, how do you think that would transpire further if he had to go beyond the Fifth Circuit to go back? Could the Supreme Court say, we already ruled on this in 1971? What is your thoughts on that?
Well, I haven't even read that case, so I don't know what they said. Do you want to enlighten us on what they said in Santabello?
Yeah, so Santabello was a unique case. This was a drug case, and in a nutshell, basically, Santabello had cut a plea deal, and he was going to give so many years of probation. He was going to avoid jail time. But during that time, his lawyer, original lawyer, stepped down, and there was a different prosecutor, so he kind of waited during some time, actually, when they made the plea. So things went further. He got back into court to actually plea in front of the judge, and the prosecutor, a different one, had changed the agreement, and at that time, he basically had taken it all the way to the Supreme Court, and they overruled that. He already made the original deal and the original contract. He just didn't happen to be in court to plea at that time. Give you a good case of mine. I actually did the plea, and I didn't go to court for 2 weeks later, so I can see that there may be some time difference on actually showing up to court to actually do it in front of the judge to get that on the record. But that's essentially how it happened.
So yeah, I didn't read the case. I wasn't, and I'm not prepared to talk intelligently about Santabello.
Shall we bounce over to the next article?
Sure.
All right. This next one, I don't know what NCSL, National Conference of State Legislatures, is. Someone had given me this article and said, do you think that they could make special license plates for registrants, PFRs? And this is, I think there's a summary of people that have different states that have license plate requirements for various things like DUIs and things like that. And just wanted to bounce the idea around, could they make license plates for PFRs?
Well, of course they could.
Wouldn't that like immediately start doing some kind of compelled speech kind of thing?
Of course it would. But remember, they can do anything. They can do anything until they're stopped, and it would be presumed constitutional. When they, if a legislature were to, a legislature in the country were to decide to require PFRs to have a plate, it would go through the process, be signed by the governor, it would be presumed constitutional, it would be on the PFRs to challenge it.
So we all start driving around with big red blocks of blah, blah, blah on our license plate that says something nasty on it, like sex offender, just like stamped across the middle of it.
Well, I mean, I think that the challenge would be a very, very good challenge, and I think that that would be one of those things where you could probably get injunctive relief from out of the box, because it doesn't take a lot to prove the emotional reaction that this would cause and the target, but we have that target on people's homes already. So the logical extension of that would be to have it on their vehicles, wouldn't it? I mean, they don't just stay in their homes all the time.
Definitely not. And you know, and we also have a handful of examples of driver's licenses.
Yes, we do.
And gentlemen, Minnesota does that. They've been doing that when I moved from Texas. It's called whiskey plates. Starts with a W. It's typically your second DUI in the state, and then once you get that, you have to have whiskey plates on for the entire time of your probation. So they have been doing that. And to go a little further, last year there was a senator who wanted to put sex offender on the license plate. It didn't go anywhere, and luckily it didn't even get out of the committee hearing. But certainly he's going to try again next session. But whiskey plates have been around for years.
Well, I think, but the way you distinguish, though, it's confined to within the period of punishment. There's a lot of latitude afforded to what you can do to people. You can't do anything you can imagine when people are being punished, but there's a lot more latitude because you're repaying a debt to society. And arguably, if you don't want to have this marking, we have another place where you will not have to have this marking, and we won't require this at all. We have another alternative program for you. And you know what that would be, right?
I think I do, but what is the answer?
So when you're being punished for a crime, and if you don't like the terms of the punishment that you're going to have in the community, there is an alternative program they have where you would not be subject to those requirements.
Oh, you could go back to jail or prison.
Yeah. So, but when the punishment ends, the whiskey plate comes off, right, Christian?
Yes, yes, it does. Correct. Yes.
And that's the same thing about registration. A registry that was fit within a person's punishment. I'm not saying any type of registry you could conceive of, but a registration period of some sort would be very difficult to challenge if it fit within the contours of the person's punishment. The only problem is it doesn't. But in terms of if they were to specifically design this as to be part of the punishment, and the people would have some marking on their license plate, and if they were which lawmakers were never capable of doing this, so there's no worry. But even though I can say this, they're not going to do it because they always believe in the broad brush. But if you were to use the license plates very narrowly and strategically towards a certain type of offender, and if you actually had a process that would allow them to escape that, to not have that, some sort of review process to see if it was appropriate, you could probably do that for the PFRs. But the state never likes to have due process because it costs money. Therefore, they would never actually narrowly tailor. They don't. That's not even in their vocabulary, to narrowly tailor something. They're not capable. It's like what we're getting to the later segment about the police policing themselves. That is not something that they can do themselves. They just can't. And we would not be able to expect lawmakers to narrowly tailor something. That's just beyond their vocabulary.
Well, all right then. So we're all going to, the other thing about having like a driver, like a license plate thing. So to relate it to coronavirus, like I saw somebody, you know, the little like fold out things that you put in your car to block the sun, and they just kind of like fold up into like a big circle. So like you put this thing around your waist and it creates a 6-foot diameter thing that you can now walk around. And now you know what your 6-foot separation thing is. So put that on your car. So now you have to have like some sort of bubble around your car that would indicate that you are a person that nobody should be near because you are a PFR.
I expect these type of proposals to really not catch on. There's a lot of pushback on this type of thing. It's been debated. It's not something new. If you look on the NCSL, that these type of things have been around for a long time. Proposals for this.
All right. Well, then we are going to move over to, this has got to be my favorite article of the night. This is the Marshall Project. It says, first came the pandemic, then came the raw sewage. So these are prisons in Texas where they have had some plumbing problems, but the administration will not admit that they are having any sort of plumbing problems. And they told them that the inmates that they couldn't flush their toilets, they couldn't wash their hands, and they couldn't use water for days, and they were pooing on top of pooing on top of pooing. It's really disgusting.
Well, what do you? I mean, Andy, for God's sakes, if we have plumbing problems, what do you expect us to do? Turn all these people loose?
I mean, I don't know what the alternative is. In the article, they describe that the prisons, most of the prisons in Texas, are just so old that you're either going to have to put some money into it, or maybe you're going to have to either build new facilities, or maybe you got to let some folks go home because this junk's expensive.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the points was made was that the town had water problems and they had to curtail the amount of water given to the prison.
Christian, I'm sure you have some sort of points that you'd like to make on this.
No, I do write some people in prison, and grown fond of some of these people, and some of them a little bit needy, but I have heard some horrible stories that I can't imagine. Now, take this. Larry, you're probably, pretty dry heat. Andy, you're probably pretty humid in Georgia, but take it down to South Texas, and you get 96, 97, 99 degrees right now, and it's hot, and it's a little oppressive, a little dry and humid, and think about the way the prison smells, and think about what they're having to live with daily. It's horrific. Yeah.
Well, I would not want to be confined in those places for any length of time without water.
I go back to what I say over and over again, though the prisons are a direct reflection of Texans, and it tends to run the gamut across the southern United States. They do not want to spend any money on prisons, and they want people to suffer immensely. If you were to go, and I don't care what city you pick in Texas, you can pick whatever you think is the liberal part of Texas. And if you even picked, I guess Austin would probably be the liberal Mecca of Texas. Absolutely. If you went into Austin and you pulled out a cross section of people and you ask them, do you think we should go on a building bench to build new prisons, have air conditioned, good facilities, and enhance the programming? And you wouldn't even find support for that at a large level in Austin. Texans want the people to suffer. They do not want the prisons air conditioned. They take great satisfaction, like Sheriff Arpaio did with his pink underwear and his no air conditioning and the green bologna and the things he did to humiliate inmates. Texans feel good knowing that prisoners are suffering and maybe they won't want to come back. That's the attitude of too many Texans. I'm not saying everybody, so don't mislead. There's some people in Texas who don't feel that way. But if you're talking to the average citizen in Texas, they don't want the prisons to be different. If they did, they would be.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the mentality, and you're absolutely right, Larry. And that's I don't think that's going to change. Not like California had filed some lawsuits with some overpopulation or sanitation issues, but Texas wouldn't go that far, and that certainly wouldn't go that far anyway in Texas. But yeah,
there was one other little block in there that I want to say that there was a section in there where like people showed up to their details, like into the cafeteria, the chow hall, and like their clothing had been used to mop up some, because they got the water running and then it kind of backfired, so they like reversed the gears on the water and it came back into the unit. So they were like mopping up the floors with their clothing, so they show up to work with poo stained clothing, and they smelled really nice. I'm pretty sure that's this article. Yes. It says they smelled overwhelmingly of urine and feces.
Yeah.
Larry, we are terrible people.
Well, we've got budgetary constraints. Do you expect us to actually put more money into prisons? I mean, and I'm not saying this, it's partially tongue in cheek, but it's partially serious. Every revenue stream is going to be adversely impacted in every state, some states more so than others. But revenue to fund government is going to be under great stress. And unlike the federal government, where they just simply put it on the charge account, most states don't have that option. They have to pretend their budget is balanced. And if your revenue is down by 30%, you're going to have to look for places to cut. And of course, no one wants to be cut. So then, since no one wants to be cut, then the question is, what do you cut and what do you not cut? Well, law enforcement generally tends to be something that gets cut the least and cuts last. But prisons, as far as the facilities themselves, the actual structure and the programs for the inmates, those things are vulnerable because those people don't have a lot of political clout. Now, they're not going to want to reduce staff because we have a security problem if we do that. They can cut medical, they can cut food, they can cut a lot of things related to prisons, but they're not going to want to cut the staff, because if they were to reduce the staff by one, there would be a massive escape. You know, it's the scare tactics that we're going to get into later they would use. But prisons are going to be low on the totem pole in terms of getting their funding. You got a whole lot of other things that states fund, and prisons are not nearly as popular as those other programs are.
I see. Well, let's move over to the appeal. Which, again, the Joshua Vaughn, I think you've said that you don't remember who this is, but he was at the Ohio conference, and he writes a whole lot of articles related to criminal justice stuff. And this article is, less than 0.5% of Pennsylvania prisoners have been granted the emergency release during the pandemic. Again, we have people that probably, you know, they're short-term, they're elderly, they already have pre-existing kinds of conditions that they could be released early, furloughed, temporary suspension, all these things. And like Governor Wolf has signed off on 153 reprieves, and only 140 people have been released from prison as part of the program. Again, we are putting these people in grave danger from having the coronavirus infect the prison system, and they're not letting anybody go home.
Well, they give the kudos to the two governors that are apparently doing more. The Kentucky governor, the Democrat governor of Kentucky, Andy Beshear, and then the Republican governor in Oklahoma, Kevin Stitt. But now let's remember, a few episodes back, we talked about that governors on the Democrat side are being threatened by the opposition party that if they do this, that they're going to pay a price at the polls because they're going to be vilified. And Wolf is one of those governors. The Republicans have threatened to take him to court if he uses his executive powers too freely because they don't want a tidal wave of crime released in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
I think, I don't want to foreshadow too much, but we have another article coming out later almost describing almost that same thing with the Republican legislature stymieing something that the left wanted to do.
But the point I'm making is, in Oklahoma, I give the kudos to Stitt for doing the right thing. He won't be vilified. You won't have any Democrat lawmakers criticizing him for being more generous with reprieves. When you flip it over and you have a Democrat governor, and if the Republicans run the legislature, they will vilify the Democrat governor for letting people go. So the Democrat is worried about his or her political career. Stitt doesn't have that to worry about because no one will vilify him over this particular issue. They may vilify him for something else. I'm not saying that Democrats don't vilify Republicans, but they don't do it generally over this particular issue.
Christian, anything you want to add?
No, nothing on this one. I did read this printed out copy, guys, by the way, that I held in my hand. But nothing.
You printed out all the
one.
Articles?
You did. I had to use
a whole ream of paper.
Well, Andy, I'll tell you this. I really appreciate you this week because last week I printed out all those articles last week that I missed, and boy, that was a lot. That was like 300 pages. Trust me, the state that I work for the state, and I'm like, where's the paper, Christian? This, I'm like, oh, there's only a few pages. This is great. So.
So are you telling me that the hardworking taxpayers of Minnesota have paid for this extravaganza of yours of printing these articles?
Yes, they have. I should. Luckily, no last names are here. Thank goodness. But yeah.
Yeah, no one will know who you are.
That's good.
But are they releasing anybody up in Minnesota that you're aware of?
Say that one more time, Andy. I'll repeat that.
Are they releasing anybody in Minnesota that you're aware of?
No, they're not. I tell you, Andy, you probably know who this is. And Larry, I know for sure you know this is. I do write back and forth with Josh Galen, and you know who he is, waiting for the civil commitment in Virginia. He has a group called Justice. I forgot the exact name of it, but they had petitioned the governor to let the people out of Moose Lake, which is a civil commitment facility, and I think there's 700 people total in the state. He did try to push that. Of course, that wasn't going to go anywhere either, so yeah.
I do know who that is, by the way.
Okay, I wasn't for sure, but yeah.
Yeah.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
Well, I think that covers the fun short side of like the news articles that we can go into what we should probably title like the abuse of power and possibly a day of reckoning coming for the abuse of power from our law enforcement apparatus, as you would like to call it, Larry. We have a bunch of clips and a bunch of articles that we can go through and discuss the coming changes whenever you are ready, Larry.
Well, I'm going to try to set this up. And folks, what I've tried to do is to do some analogies of the present versus the past, because I have this crazy thing I do is I look backwards to look forward, and I take a lot of abuse for that. But that's how I predict the future, because the past will tell us a lot about what people will do in the future. And as I'm watching, and we were talking last week, I said that the police will engage in terror, scare tactics, and they will try to terrorize the citizens if we begin to try to assert control. And that is beginning to already unfold. There, the Tucker Carlson and Sean Hannity, both, everybody I think that listened to us have at least heard those names. But Tucker Carlson said that the left is wanting to defund the police and abolish the police and all these untrue things. But what I've got is a series of clips tonight. And a city councilor in Minneapolis wants to reduce the increase of the police budget. And he's already being vilified. And then a lot of people that are in the registry position that we have, the battle we're fighting, they say the media is so horrible. And they didn't used to be that way. Yeah, I hate to break it to you. They did. We just didn't have as much of it in yesteryear. So I was thinking about what kind of event can I use to illustrate the point about the scare tactics that were used. And I went back to 1981 when the traffic controllers decided to strike against the U.S. government. So we're approaching 40 years since that strike. And there were predictions made by the strikers about all these dreadful things that would happen. And, of course, none of them did. Nothing dreadful happened of the predictions that were made. But the same thing the police are going to do. They're going to tell us all these dreadful things that will happen. So let's start with clip one from the MSNBC.
All right, here we go.
The place where this current American uprising all started, of course, is Minneapolis, Minnesota, where a number of elected officials in the state are pushing for police reform. One of those officials is City Council member Steve Fletcher, and he had this just incredible Twitter thread yesterday talking about his attempt at reform and basically being stymied at every turn by the Minneapolis Police Union. Quote, politicians who cross the Minneapolis Police Department find slowdowns in their wards. After the first time I cut money from the proposed police budget, I had an uptick in calls, taking forever to get a response, and Minneapolis Police Department officers telling business owners to call their councilmen about why it took so long. Minneapolis City Council Member Steve Fletcher joins me now. Thanks for joining us, Council Member. Maybe you could start by giving us a little context about policing and the Minneapolis Police Department in your city, even before George Floyd's death and the latest protests.
Absolutely. So we have been struggling with police accountability for many, many years. We have known it was a problem. Many of us on the city council ran on police reform and on police accountability. This is not the first person to die at the hands of the Minneapolis Police Department. It is certainly the one that is the clearest about it being just utterly inexcusable and indefensible. So I think this has sparked a new level of outrage, but this is something that we have been working on. And as I talked about, it's something that I've been trying to, in incremental ways, begin to chip away at, begin to think about what functions of the police could we replace with other kinds of responses? What ways can we create accountability to make sure that there's discipline for abuse of power and misuse of the use of force? It's been very challenging.
What has happened when you have attempted things like, for instance, cutting police budgets? This is something that's kind of sacrosanct in many cities, many major cities around the country. Police take up 40-50% of the total budget for the entire city. What has the organized opposition from both the police department and the police union been like when there are any attempts to do that?
And the ironic thing is we weren't even proposing a cut to their budget. We were proposing a cut to a proposed increase. So it felt to me like it was probably insufficiently progressive for even what I had run on in some ways. And we still had, they're very good at organizing a base of sort of law and order conservatives and also scaring people by either implying that they'll be aggressive about enforcement about something or that they will slow down enforcement about something. So I start getting calls saying, hey, there's a guy sitting in our parking lot stalking one of my employees, and we're calling 911 about it, and they're saying, oh, we can't do anything about it. Talk to your council member.
Now, Larry, why would you get like the super over the top left wing nut job clip on this publication here?
Well, I didn't view it quite that extreme over the top. I'm trying to prepare people for what the police are going to do. We're in a battle that we haven't seen. And these people are not going to go down easy. They've had total control, total support, no questions, no control. I mean, they've had the control, but the citizens have virtually no control over them for so long. They're not going to want to give that up. And so I'm trying to do what I do best is tell people, look, this battle is going to be a tough one. And so that's the backdrop for this. Christian, do you know that counselor? I know you don't live in Minneapolis proper.
No, not at all, but close to it in the suburbs. No, not particularly that city council. I do know that the school districts had pushed Minneapolis police there. They want to disband the police, and they just want to use the Hennepin County Sheriff's Department. But again, I don't think that that's going to go anywhere. Minneapolis is very diverse. You have a large Somalian population. So, and again, if you guys know, it was a U.S. Congressman, Keith Ellison. He's now Attorney General for Minnesota. His son is one of the city council members as well. So I think it's going to go round and round for a while until this kind of quiets down. But they certainly want to cut the police force at this point.
Well, I want to dig into that point you made there, because that's part of the scare tactics that Tucker Carlson and Sean Hannity are using. Now, you're talking about, for those who don't know Minnesota, Minneapolis, the county, it is Hennepin County. And what they're talking about doing is, since they can't control the police department, is they're talking about having a unified police structure where it would be under the Hennepin County Sheriff's, which would be an elected position. And I'm not sure that the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office is without fault as well. But they're not talking about just having lawlessness and no law enforcement. They're talking about shifting from having a sheriff's department and a police department to having the sheriff be the law enforcement entity for the entire county. Do I have that right, Christian?
That is correct, yes.
And so the scare tactics that you hear, that they want to abolish the police, they want to abolish this particular agency and replace it with another agency that apparently has a better track record at policing. That's what they're wanting to do. So, but as I brought up the air traffic control strike, there's a lot of people listening that may not be old enough to remember that, 1981. But the to work for the FAA to be a traffic controller, you have to take an oath not to strike. And they decided in August of 81 that they were going to go out on strike because of their grievances had not been satisfactorily addressed. So let's do clip one.
All right, here comes clip number one.
We are on strike.
That's how local PATCO president Steve Wallert announced the beginning of the walkout in Norfolk. Then Wallert, surrounded by area controllers, charged the skies are unsafe and said there could be a tragedy.
When the civilian controllers in France went on strike, the French government attempted to run the traffic system with military controllers. Within 72 hours, there was a mid-air collision. I would hate to see that happen in the United States.
But at the local FAA office, where security has been beefed up to prevent any sabotage, Tower Chief Bill Commander says it's as safe to fly today as yesterday.
If it's not safe, we're going to keep them on the ground. We may slow things down and not handle as many airplanes, but safety is the first consideration, and the operation will be safe, I can assure you.
But many...
Larry, there's a certain tonal quality. Like, I'm completely, like, side-railing the conversation for a moment, but, like, there's just a certain tonal quality of how the things were produced 40 years ago.
And let me say something, Larry, and I do kind of remember, because I do like a lot of political and historical things. It was the Reagan years, and it was a union issue. And didn't Reagan kind of push this sort of, he was for them, and he brought in scabs, as we know the union term, bringing in the scabs to kind of cover them during the time. I don't know how well they did, if there was any collisions at that time, but I think Reagan had a part in this in the Republican Party, I believe.
Would you say for them? Which them? He wasn't for the controllers.
Not for union. That Reagan was not for the union, or at least the federal government. Yeah. You know, I work for the federal government. I worked for the Air Force at one point. We had a American Federation of Government Employees. I know that the federal government didn't appreciate or like the federal government, the union, because we're working for the public. We're working for you. So what's the purpose of having a union? Why do we need one when we're in the public sector? And that's the thing I got when I was employed from the federal government.
Well, that was the very conversation I was hoping to avoid in terms of the merits of the strike and who did what. But it was during the first year of the Reagan administration of his first term. It was in August, and he had been inaugurated in January. And he made a point that they had pledged and signed not to strike, and therefore that their strike was unlawful. And he gave them a period to come back to work, which they declined to do so. And then they were all fired. And I wasn't wanting to debate the merits of the strike. It was about the sensationalism. You heard the threat that the planes were going to fall from the sky, and I don't want to say that that's going to happen, but it's a possibility. It's a possibility. Yeah, that was what I was trying to get out of that clip. And then let's do clip two now.
All right, number two.
Norfolk controllers are standing strong in their vow to stay off the job, despite President Reagan's threat to fire controllers who don't report for work by 11 a.m. Wednesday. Local Patco President Steve Wallert says he isn't worried.
What's the president going to do when we all get fired? What's the United States government going to do when 13,000 air traffic controllers are out of work?
Wallert says it would take years to train enough people to replace all Patco members, and he once again charged the skies are not safe.
Yesterday they had a near midair over in New Jersey, 15,000 feet between, I believe it was an Air Canada and a New York Air. I don't want to predict there'd be an accident, but the possibility exists that there could be an accident, a serious one.
Meantime, here at North.
Okay, so we've heard two clips and two scary to death. Now, I lived through that. Not a single plane fell from the sky in 1981, 82, 83 that I can recall. I recall that the air traffic control system was under stress. I recall that they had to slow down the number of planes. They had to, in those days, they had huge peak times in the morning, and they had a morning and an evening push, and they had to reduce the number of planes. They had to manage the flights, but nothing fell from the sky. All the Armageddon that they predicted, it would take all these years to rebuild air traffic control, was wrong. They were able to restaff the towers, and they were able to have a safe air traffic control system. And the point I'm making is, I'm not taking sides in the strike, but they were using those scare tactics 40 years ago, just like they're doing now, about all these dreadful things that are going to happen.
How are the cats going to get pulled out of the trees if the police are removed, if they're defunded and all that?
I don't think they've done much of that for a long time. So
guess it's the fire department anyway.
So let's go ahead and do clip three of the series.
I do want to tell you that all of these clips, they all came in with just like the left channel. So I had to go do some finagling to get it to be both sides.
I don't know what the left channel is or what both sides means.
Well, you have two ears, so one of them is left and one of them is right. Anyway, they were recorded all on one side.
Huh.
But here's something
about that.
Norfolk controllers remain resolved not to go back to work. And at their daily press briefing, acting President Bob Cameron predicted the system will fail next week when fatigue sets in on the skeleton staff. Cameron also issued a warning to anyone who applies for a $32,000 a year controller job.
If 32 looks good as an air traffic controller, wait till you've done it for a couple years. It doesn't look like much at all. And believe me, I mean that sincerely. You 20,000 applicants, my job's available. I've been fired. Give it a try. And I'd like to talk to you in about 5 years and see how you feel then.
Now, we've got some mathematicians out there. So somebody that's in chat, convert 32,000 from 81 and forward that to today and tell us what that amount of money would be so we can have a picture of what the salary was like in 81.
But I'm totally not doing that one.
I know, but we've got 100 people in chat right now. Somebody can do that. And then the other clip is regarding that when you take a stand for something you believe in, you just might face arrest. So let's hear clip four.
The fact that he was jailed was no surprise to Norfolk Patco President Steve Wallert. The morning the strike began, Wallert said he expected to be arrested.
Do you expect to go to jail?
Yes.
What about the rest of the guys behind you? How do you assess the whole jail situation?
Our members are prepared to do whatever is necessary. They are aware of the consequences, and jail is one of those that they are... one of those consequences.
So they made a stand for what they believed in. They knew the consequences. They were breaking the law. And the entire workforce, with the exception of the few that returned, were fired. And Congress passed the changed the law in 1986 that they could be rehired. And by 1986, the FAA had long didn't need these people back. Out of the almost 13,000, I think, that went on strike, only about 600 were ever returned to work with the FAA. So, folks, life as we know it didn't end. The doom and gloom didn't happen. The scare tactics that existed 40 years ago were around then, and they're around now, and they're probably more enhanced now because they have more methods to scare you. In those days, they had the three networks and some limited PBS, but they were doing what they were doing, what they're doing now, they did decades ago. This is not anything new, so it doesn't take a genius to figure out what they're going to do because this is what they've always done.
Well, let me, I kind of want to like reveal the man behind the curtain. Why are we talking about this? Like, what does this have to do with the registry?
Well, the George Floyd really doesn't have any direct thing to do with the registry. It has to do with police accountability and police overreach. And what we do have in common is that a lot of PFRs, people forced to register, suffer a lot of police overreach, anything from invasions of their home without permission and threats if they don't cooperate. They are told to do things that are not in the statutes and threatened with prosecution. And the overreaching police who are not accountable, this is a mindset. What we want is police, when they have a function to do no more than the function. So like with Cobb County, which Cobb County, we haven't forgotten about you. We're coming for you soon. But people who invent requirements, it's because of lack of accountability. We don't want police overreaching. If we tell them that your job is to make contact with these PFRs once a year and collect this list of information, we don't want you inventing a brand new list of information and telling people that they have to do things that they're not required to do, because ideally you would like them to do that. It's not your job what you'd like them to do. So the indirect, the relationship is that our police are doing a lot of things that they shouldn't be doing, and they do it because they can. And so it's about accountability of the police and our law enforcement agencies across this country. That's the direct comparison here. But yes, I don't think that anything is cut and dry, that any of these killings were done because someone was forced to register as a sex offender.
Right. I'm with you. I just wanted, because I can see all the hate mail, like, man, you guys have gone too far away from the registry stuff. And I just wanted to make sure that we, early on, because there's still a good ways to go on this, to make sure that we described why we were bringing up this sort of agenda, something from 40 years ago, is like, what does this have to do with the registry? And it's because, like you said, that the extra overzealous attitude that law enforcement has against PFRs and the current situation with George Floyd and all of the protests and all that, they are very, they're not that tangentially related. They're fairly closely related.
Well, the next time when a registry officer shows up at your house and says, I want to come in, do you feel confident enough to say no? And the average person out there, the answer is no. And the reason why is because of the power that badge and the accompanying officers represent, the intimidation factor. Wouldn't it be nice if they were not allowed to knock at your door and demand that you comply with something that's not in the law? Wouldn't that be a better society?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Again, if you weren't like totally scared, poopless, that they're going to come in and tasers and guns blaring. And yeah, anyway, Christian, anything to add before we continue?
No. I think that this good topic, good conversation. We're hearing it every day. I know the Minneapolis Orchestra, and I forgot the other one, but there's a lot of people that discontinue the service. And of course, you're going to hear that things are going to go rogue and we're going to be lawless and just all over the place. So I think that good topics, and we'll see what's to come in Minneapolis and how this is going to shape our community and state.
Larry, I think we have an article. It might just like touch on it along the way, though, that different places have canceled their contracts. It's what Christian was just talking about. They've canceled their contracts with law enforcement to have police in schools, or maybe they're in shopping malls. This has kind of sparked a whole, like, maybe we don't need all of them running around all the time just being policing kind of people.
I felt that way. And of course, when you say what I'm about to say, we don't know what didn't happen because of the police. It's always difficult, no matter what the scenario is. But most everybody out there has probably heard of the International Balloon Fiesta because we're the largest hot air balloon festival event in certainly the country and possibly the world. Happens here in Albuquerque because of the beautiful setup we have for how ideally balloons launch and land here. When I go out to the fiesta, it always disappoints me that there's all this law enforcement. And I've never known of anything of any consequence. You have tens of thousands of people every day over the course of the fiesta. Nothing ever happens. And of course, we don't know what would have happened weren't there, but it just feels very intimidating when you've got mounted police and you've got all these people. There's just such a presence. You know, people are having a good time. They're watching beautiful balloons. They're buying things for their families. They're not out there to cause trouble. So I've always thought they could do with quite a bit less.
I understand. Are we any more clips, or are we ready to hit?
Well, we've got some more clips, but I think we're going to bring in the importance of voting a little bit later, and then okay. I think we can go ahead and do the thing about black people. We got a comment last week about that this wouldn't have been an issue about if George Floyd had been white, and I kind of took issue with that because it has been something that's been on the forefront of this podcast. I don't know how many episodes we've talked about police behavior over the top, and it hasn't been a racial thing at all for us. It's been the conduct we attack. If you slam a kid to the ground that's in junior high school or high school, I don't care what race of the kid is. I care about that. When you handcuff a woman giving birth to a child, I don't care whether she's black or white. I mean, it never enters my mind. But I responded back that the Shaver murder in the hotel in Las Vegas, he was white and young. That got a lot of notoriety. The cop was prosecuted. The jury refused to convict him. In Albuquerque with the James Boyd case, when they shot him off the side of the mountain when he was trying to surrender, he was white. There was an uproar. There was protest all over the city. A little bit of it got out of control, and he was prosecuted, and he won like the cops typically do. They don't return guilty verdicts. But I don't see that that's the point. But anyway, that was the not just black lives. If we play that clip, nobody's saying that this is only affects black people.
It's not just black males that it's happening to. Look at the Sandra Blands, and now look at this. And it's children. Children. Children that were treated as if they had just robbed a bank or shot up a church. And I use shot up a church because when we were in Charleston fighting for Walter Scott, that happened. And do you know how he was apprehended? With fast food and a smile. And politely put in handcuffs. And I remember sitting in my hotel room looking at the TV, stunned.
Going back to something that you were just talking about, like we covered things where the school resource officer, which whatever you want to call it, like the cop in the school body slammed some kid that was going down the hallway.
Yeah, it's certainly, I think that I don't want to speak for the person because he's not here to speak for himself, but I think that he's overreacting that this is somehow a black issue. You're more likely going to have an escalating behavior if you're black. What will set off an officer, particularly a white officer, seems to be a lower tolerance. And I say that because I've got a lot of life experience, and I know how I get treated with a cop. I know how gently I'm treated. And then I've been in the law business long enough, watched enough video now of how the encounters go down with people who are younger and darker, and they don't react and interact the same way that they do with someone like me. And I have a friend who lives in Georgia who said he got pulled over several times because there was some stolen gasoline and his truck fit the description. And he said he got pulled over several times in the course of an hour and a half, making his way up I-75. And he said all he did is what the police told him. I said, but you got to remember, you're 60 years old. You had a spouse sitting in the vehicle with you. You didn't present a threatening profile to the officer. Therefore, the officer approached you not as a felony stop, but I'm just wondering if this red vehicle could be it. I wonder, sir, did you happen to get off at exit 72? Yeah, we got a report of a vehicle driveway on gasoline. if you had two 20-year-old black men with dreadlocks, and if the windows were slightly tinted, and that vehicle was thumping a little bit with, what do you call that, rap music, the officer would have approached that vehicle. That officer would have approached them entirely differently. So what they would have been required to do would not be the same interaction that I or you would have had. So you can't say
what you're saying is that your friend is saying that they shouldn't be black.
Well, he's not saying that directly, but he's acting as if how he's treated is representative of how everybody's treated when they interact with the police, and it isn't. You know, the college students in Atlanta, I mean, ideally he would have kept moving when the officer said, you know, keep moving. But he didn't. He had someone that was outside the vehicle, as I understand it, and he was trying to pick him up. And he didn't keep moving, and that irritated the police officer. The irritation level would have been a lot lower had it been someone like me. They would have said, "Sir, could you please keep moving? We got to keep traffic flowing here." but I don't think they would have tried to pull me out of the car when I didn't keep moving.
I had an interesting thought the other day. I was walking up to the bank, and I was thinking about all of the video that has surfaced over these issues, because everyone is running around with like a high definition camera in their pocket 24 hours a day. And I was thinking about, you know, there was this big scare in the 50s of UFOs, and we don't have the same corresponding photos of alien craft coming into our atmosphere with all the cameras. But all of a sudden, all these videos have surfaced of police overreach. And I was just sort of trying to draw the comparison that everyone has a camera. We should have found the UFOs by now, but we sure have found a lot of cops doing bad things.
Yeah, well, I would think so. If they were out there, we should have more objects. And when they do have an object, it's so blurry that no one can figure out what it is. And then the government tells us it's a weather balloon or it's a shadow or something like that.
Yep. All right, where are we going now?
I guess we can start going to the articles, and we need to move through them pretty fast because we've got 50 minutes left.
All right. So we will start, and we are going to start with this first article. It's from Courthouse News. Minnesota officials link arrested looters to white supremacist group. I kept hearing things like this, Larry, from different news outlets that not just the protesters, but specifically the ones that were creating the massive amounts of unrest, that they were from out of state. They might not have been part of Black Lives Matter and those various groups. And they're linking this to like white supremacist groups and other organizations that are inciting kind of violent kind of activities.
Well, I am going to punt this one to our Minnesotan to see what he knows about these supremacist groups.
Christian, what do you got? You are a muted Christian. Christian has fallen asleep.
So, all right. Well, I think that what I would say is that I have had that suspicion for a long time. People, when they judge these protests, the overwhelming tens of thousands of them that are protesting across the country are doing nothing more than just walking peaceably. But as with any crisis, anything presents an opportunity for those who don't have the best of intentions to blend in. And it's hard for you to know if you're walking with a group of 700 people or 1,000 or whatever it may case, you don't know all 700 or 1,000, and you don't know what their intentions are. So therefore, as you're making your way towards your final destination where you're going to make your stand and hold your signs and chant, you don't know what anyone's going to do until they do it. But it presents a beautiful opportunity for people who have sinister intentions. And I wish the law enforcement would say the same thing that they ask of themselves. Law enforcement cops, please don't judge the tens and hundreds of thousands of people who have protested correctly. Don't paint them all with that same brush because a few instigators, for whatever the reasons are, have tried to exploit this for their own agenda. What we do is we arrest those people. And at last count, I know over 5,000 people had been arrested across the country. But we deal with those 5,000 and the other hundreds of thousands that have protested. They shouldn't be painted with that brush. And I don't know anything about this white supremacy. Hopefully Christian can tell us what they know in Minnesota.
Christian?
Sure. So if you guys can hear me, I was having some difficulty.
Yes.
We had the protesters, calm, peaceful, wanted to get the message across about law enforcement and then justice in the community. Then you had the unruly ones that caused havoc and burn and destruction and so forth. And at that point, they don't have a justification to go that far. They didn't have a reason. I think they just had an excuse to do what they wanted to do. There was a lot of spin in Minnesota. The governor said that 80% were out of state, coming in from out of state, from Fergus and Ferguson, I believe, and some other places to cause havoc. But it wasn't the truth. It turns out that they were from Minnesota. They were a younger population. And that's just the case. So both sides, the protesters abided by the curfew. They went inside when it was time. The unruly ones didn't. But as far as the white supremacy, the Department of Corrections commissioner and the governor had said that there was reports of white supremacy passing out literature and here to help increase the violence. That wasn't actually confirmed. So, but there was presence of Antifa that were in Minnesota.
Let's move over to an article from USA Today. It was federal prisons under national lockdown amid George Floyd protests, most severe restrictions in 25 years. I think this goes along with another article that we'll have in a few about the Federal Bureau of Prisons taking their incident response team, tax squad, whatever, and sending them into hotspots like Miami and DC. I think that's actually another article coming up. So because those units aren't available at the prison, well, God, we got to lock everybody down in the prison. We can't have any movement. And so that's not good. So they've already been locked down because of COVID, and now they're being locked down because the police are prison is redirecting resources.
Well, I would just like for the prison people that are listening, that there's an audience out there that's never been incarcerated. When you hear the term lockdown, if you've not been in a facility, tell people what that means in terms of a lockdown, because the average person who hasn't been in a jail, they think, well, they're locked in. That's the whole point. So what does a lockdown mean in terms of your daily ritual?
Depending on if you're in a cell, if you're in a one or two man cell, you're just stuck in your cell, and maybe they'll do limited movement to get you to the chow hall to do food, or they'll open the door and throw a pack out, like a little bag of a peanut butter sandwich with some chips and a cup of Kool-Aid in there. Like that could be the extreme of you're just stuck in your cell. If you're in an open, what?
But as opposed to a normal day, you'd be doing a job, right? You'd be out, you'd be moving around. If you would have some kind of duty, a porter, or whether you do the yards, or whether you work as a barber, you've got some kind of duty to perform. So you're locked down in a very small confined area, 24 hours a day, roughly.
Yeah, and even when they start doing that stuff, well, then there's no yard, so those people don't go to work, and maybe they'll do haircuts. I mean, obviously people are still going to go to do food, but the library would be shut down. I mean, anything outside of essential services. Hey, we know about essential services now. You wouldn't necessarily have had a frame of reference of what would be considered essential prior to 2 months ago. But then even still, if you're in an open dorm, what are you supposed to do? They would lock you down and say, you just can sit on your bed. You can't move around to other people's beds and hang out and talk or, do whatever you would do, play cards. You're just stuck at your bunk for days, weeks.
Okay. And what does a lockdown do to the tension level in a facility in terms of when that type of confinement and no movement does? What would be the result of the, would the prison population be easier to manage or more difficult to manage in that environment?
I think that would actually be answered. It would be both, Larry, because if you don't have people moving, there's not much to manage, but you do have a powder keg inside the unit. People are going to get pissed off. They're going to, they're not outside. They're not getting any sun. They're not getting releasing any energy anywhere, playing basketball or something like that. So yeah, tension level can go through the roof. And as soon as someone says, "Hey man, what's up?" Now, you've now said something that offends me. So then shit just breaks out and things get ugly.
Well, that was the point I was making, that we need to return prisons to as much normal operation as we can, as quickly as we can, if we don't want to have violence, because that's where this is going to lead to if we don't. And I'm not trying to do scare tactics like we just heard. This is just the reality of what happens in prisons. The reason why we learned decades ago what we've learned about prison management is that we have to have something that consumes the energy and the attention of inmates. If they have nothing but boredom, the outcome is not going to be good after a prolonged period of time. So we need the prisons to be returned to normal operations as quickly as they can.
Very good. And then from WHYY, police reforms in Pennsylvania languished after Antoine Rose's killing. Will now be any different? I think this is another roughly similar. It says, in June 2018, a police officer shot and killed Antoine Rose II, an unarmed black teenager in a small borough outside of Pittsburgh. Oh, this is what I was referred to a couple articles ago about, where Rose's death led to an emotional protest, the arrest of the officer, and a package of police reform bills introduced by Democrats, legislation that went nowhere in the Republican-controlled state legislature. I brought that up a handful of articles ago about change trying to be introduced, but then being stymied.
Yes, and this is the place where it would fit in a nice clip, the importance of voting. This is the response to people who have watched the reform efforts be stymied in Pennsylvania. If you don't like it, listen to this.
That's still not enough, even charging them. There has to be policing change. Why is that so hard? How many more examples do y'all need? What chief doesn't want to change a system that you clearly see is broken? And if a politician doesn't want to, then fine. It is just time to start voting people out of office. African Americans don't typically turn out in the mass that they could. Well, now you've awoken them. You want to see what a vote can do now? Stand up against trying to change.
So,
and to that, Larry, like, I recall, so the Colin Kaepernick kneeling for the national anthem and whatnot from last NFL season, I know you're not a sports fan, neither am I, but I'm sure you heard about it.
Sure.
And the NFL came out and severely condemned. The president was running around saying that these SOBs and whatnot. And just today, yesterday, the NFL has come out and said, we were wrong and we're not going to sanction anybody that wants to kneel for the flag and all this stuff. And I remember people in my area, they were like, I'm not watching the NFL until they get, you know, until they squelch this, this protest. And I was like, holy crap, you guys are crazy. These people like are getting beat up and killed by police. So somebody takes a knee on the field and you're going to boycott watching the NFL. I thought it was ridiculous that they would take the stance, let alone not agree with the stance.
Well, I never understood the whole thing again, because I always thought kneeling, I thought that was an act of reverence. I never understood. I truly didn't understand it, because I never thought that was a when you kneel at church, you're not being disrespectful to God Almighty, are you? So I thought kneeling was a good thing to do.
And I can guarantee you now we're going to get hate mail. But my understanding is Colin Kaepernick actually like counseled with a Navy SEAL to say, what would be the most respectful thing that I could do to do this? And this is what he was recommended to do, was to kneel. Yeah, you're right. I mean, like, you know, you kneel when you go into church and do various things like that. Like, you kneel. Like, you kneel before you kiss the ring of the Pope, I'm sure.
Yeah, I never understood that. But beyond that silly part of it, this whole country is founded upon the freedom of expression. Now, you are on the job. You are on the employer's time. And you have somewhat less right to express yourself on the company time. So therein lies the problem. I do recognize when you're working at your regular job, try telling your employer that you have unlimited freedom of expression and see what happens. So I do, but I just didn't see that as being all that disrespectful. And I didn't understand the controversy. It went over my head.
I get it. Christian, you just jump in here if there's anything that you want to say, because we're gonna bounce through these things really quick. But if there's anything that you want to add,
no. And I'm glad you talked about that. One of my favorite quarterbacks is Drew Brees, New Orleans Saints. I love him to death. And you know, he made a comment that he didn't believe you should kneel during the national anthem, and the NFL commissioner came back and popped off. And we know how power and political this can get. And then immediately he backed off his story, and I was kind of ashamed that he didn't keep his platform and his views and change that. I don't know why. I guess if you're going to have that, keep your views and keep them, and regardless of the backlash. But anyway.
Yep. Over at corrections1.com, never heard of this one. Oh, this brings it up. It says, Attorney General Barr sends BOP riot team to D.C. and Miami. So BOP is the Bureau of Prisons. The move to send the BOP's special operations response teams comes as violence continues across the country. I still can't fathom how this happened. And then, like, I don't think we have anything that covers this one. Larry, did you read that he signed the order for the police in D.C. to clear the path for the president?
I'm not clear on that for sure, but it was a strange reaction to what I thought was a peaceful demonstration to use the flash grenades and what all they did to clear out the demonstrators.
It was also, I mean, like that. So when they did that, they assaulted, they manhandled some, and forgive me for using like a very sexist kind of term, but they pushed around some reporters from other countries. And I didn't really think of the political impact of this, but our allies, like, I think there was a German, maybe it was an Australian news group that got kind of pushed around. And like that creates some pretty significant political tensions when you run around and you push their news reporters, you know, First Amendment, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, like that kind of thing. Don't we espouse to have that be one of our mantras?
Well, yes. And beyond that, we need to remember how we feel when this happens to an American journalist.
Bet you we would be a little PO'd about that one.
And that sometimes we struggle with how we react differently. When an example would be when an American is being held captive, arrested without due process, or what we would consider due process, the president or the State Department, usually not the president directly, though occasionally it is, but usually the State Department contacts that nation and asks for intervention, and they go to the upper levels of the government. When that happens in the reverse, what happens here in the United States when you contact the State Department, or if you had the president's number, and it's not singled out for Trump, it would be any president. The president always defers and says, well, it's a state matter, you know, to have a death penalty in Texas, and it's state law, and there's nothing I can do about it. I can't commute a sentence. But we get very angry if the leaders of other countries are not able to intervene to our satisfaction. We have a lot of struggle with reversing something and looking at it through the eyes of the foreign nation.
Let's see here. So then we have a couple articles that kind of center around a similar theme. Officers charged in George Floyd's death not likely to present a united front. This is from the New York Times. That I think it is pretty typical in our past that there's, I think it's called the blue wall, where you can't get any information out of officers. They lock arms together and they present a united front of supporting their own. And I think one of the officers in this thing is already like trying to cut a deal and sell out his coworkers there. And all that. This, Larry, these guys are going to get convicted.
Well, they're the that's yet to be determined.
I will bet you money right here. Like, you've had money invested for the last 350 years, so you got a truckload of money in the bank. I will bet you one penny that these guys get convicted.
When you say these guys, are you talking about the Chauvin, or are you talking about
yes, him and his little, you know, the two. Go ahead. Christian, go ahead.
I do agree with you, Andy. I do agree with you, Andy, and I think it's going to be very difficult. And Larry, you may agree with this too. How are you going to have a fair trial in the state of Minnesota, especially in the cities, when probably a majority of the people have came out and expressed concern about the police force? I don't know how he's going to get a fair trial in this whole matter. I don't. So I think he will be convicted, or whether he pleads and cuts it down as a shorter sentence.
It would be hard to offer Chauvin any type of plea. Now, you can offer these other four men a plea because they were not the primary responsibility doesn't lie with them. He was their training officer, according to the article. At least two of them were in training, and he had seniority over all of them. But it says he was a 19-year veteran. But I think a fair trial is going to be a very difficult thing to do, and he's entitled to that. We have to want him. We have to be as adamant about him having a fair trial as we are about anybody. We do not want this to be overturned on appeal because of not being a fair trial. We want him to get the process that all of us would expect. And they set $750,000 bond on these four officers, and this will probably get me some hate mail, but I think that bond is over the top. I don't know if they're going to be able to post it, if they have posted it, those four. But that is an excessive amount of bond for people who do not pose any reasonable flight risk. The purpose of a bond for a cash respond is to have a sufficient incentive for the person to participate. And a sufficient incentive would be far less than $750,000. And they didn't commit a violent crime. They witnessed a violent crime, and it's questionable what they could have done to prevent that. That's all to be cited. But I think that is an excessive amount to require, and they should be able to have a reasonable bail, just like we would want if we were charged with a crime, right?
We would definitely want that. So then another article from the New York Times, this one is just dated a handful of days ago. It says, another man who said, I can't breathe, died in custody. An autopsy calls it homicide. It says, Manuel Ellis of Tacoma, Washington, died in part as a result of how he was restrained, according to the medical examiner, who concluded that his death was a homicide. I suspect that this is going to be the continuing trend, that the chokeholds of the Eric Gardners, the random deaths while you're riding in a police van from point A to point B, I think he had a broken back. I think that's what the Baltimore one was. Like, this stuff is all going to be put under the light, Larry. Like, it is my opinion that this has definitely hit a tipping point, that this is not going to continue to happen.
Well,
Teresa says that's Freddie Gray.
The Minneapolis has already taken, Christian can chime in here, but they've already taken some steps in terms of requiring that these holes not be used and that people doing this be reporting them. But I don't understand. I'd say about 30 years ago, I may be off of my years, but the animal control for our city, they used to use that for cats. When they were catching a stray, they would reach that had the noose around. And then if you're catching a feral cat, the feral cat's not going to be the least bit cooperative. They would pick those cats up by the neck, and that cat would eventually go out because of no oxygen. And that's how they were able to put the feral cat in the cage to take them to animal control. And we were able to decide 25 to 30 years ago that you can't do that because it harms the cat, and cats died. And cats were, so 30 years later, we're having this discussion about not choking human beings to death. Am I missing something?
I do not believe so. Larry, in the interest of time, I want to cover one article, if you're okay with us skipping to the end of the roster. And it's this one, movement to defund police gains unprecedented support across the U.S. And I heard this on some other publications where I want to say it's in Los Angeles that the police budget is $1.8 billion. And instead of them getting a 7% increase, there's going to be a small decrease in their budget. And this seems to be a trend. And it's something that you have said on the podcast before of like, we have a militarized police department and we should be the ones that restrained their tools and stop giving them so much money to do all these things. And I just wanted to get your feedback on this.
Well, it's the only tool we have. And when the public realizes that, I'll make the analogy with Attorney General, Office of Attorney General. Each state has an Attorney General. One thing that we learned as advocates in this movement is that the Attorney General of Michigan, you pick your state, Arkansas, they appeal everything. You remember we talked about Grabarczyk? Was it last week or the week before?
Yep,
well, they have announced exactly. I predicted they would appeal. They have to appeal, and they are appealing the Grabarczyk decision. Well, if we don't want them appealing everything, which is what they do, and fighting everything tooth and nail, since there's no one in any office in anywhere in the state of North Carolina that can order the Attorney General to do anything, the only tool that the legislature of North Carolina has and the people have indirectly through their legislators is to cut the funding. So if they have an office of 500 and they have the resources to appeal everything, one way you would stop them from being able to appeal everything would be to reduce the number of people they have, which would cause them to have to choose on appealing everything. Well, the same thing goes with the police. We're not talking about totally defunding the police. No one is talking about that. What we're talking about is that over the last 25 years, as crime has declined, the police have enjoyed a steadily increasing budget, when actually budgets should have been going down to represent the need for fewer of them because there weren't as many things to investigate. The only tool we have is to say, if you don't like the fact that police, those of us who have been advocates for a number of years, we've heard about all these ridiculous cases that they've brought. You know, we've talked about on the podcast of cases that you couldn't imagine that they have time to do, that they bring these cases. And they bring these cases because they have the resources to do so. Since you can't give a sheriff an order not to do something, the only thing you can do is say, well, sheriff, if you've got resources to bring all these dubious cases, we're going to curtail your activities by having fewer funds available. Well, the sheriff isn't going to like that. So what they're going to do is exactly what the counselor in Minnesota did. They're going to retaliate by saying, okay, we're going to back off on things you want enforced, or we're going to come down hard on other things to teach the public a lesson. And that's what they're going to do. They know no other playbook. That's all they can do. We're going to have to stand firm, and we're going to have to say, sorry, folks, we're in a budget crisis. Revenues are down. You're going to have to tighten your belt, and you're going to have to do with less. This pandemic is a perfect opportunity to do something you could never do in regular circumstances. You could never talk about actually cutting the police department's budget. Prior to this pandemic, you could talk about possibly giving them a slower increase like Councillor Fletcher was talking about. But now we can actually have a discussion, because I get to look you as in a taxpayer and say, well, look, our revenues are down 30% because of the pandemic. Would you like to have a tax increase so that we can get the revenue flow back up to where it was so that we don't have to cut anything? Of course, you know what the answer to that is. Nobody wants a tax increase because now since the police make up 50% of the budget, now this is true across the country, not just in Minneapolis, since law enforcement gets the lion's share of local funding, how could we cut 30% of the city or county's budget if we have to take 50% of it out of the equation? What would 30% of 50%? You mathematicians figure that out. If I had to cut spending 30% and I could only look at 50% to cut the 30%, what would the cut be to the remaining programs?
It would be a lot. I want to say it's like in the 80% range.
So that's what we're up against here. And I didn't mean to go on so long, Christian. What is your take? We've lost him again.
Larry, can you repeat that?
I said, what's your take? I didn't mean to go on so long. So what's your take about the...
No. I think that you have a good point. And it's a lot of things that are just going through my mind right now with this, with what you said. And I had to work. Since I worked with the state, I had to do some traffic control and roadblocks during this time. And it was... brutal watching some of this. So I kind of wanted to stay back, whether anything was politically motivated or if race was an issue and, you know, so forth. But yeah.
Is there anything else that we want to hit before we get out of here?
Christian, is there any of the articles there that we didn't cover that you wanted to cover? I know we've got the warrant. I wanted to at least say something about the Breonna Taylor.
Okay.
The danger of doing what they did, come to find out, as more and more facts were known about that no-knock warrant, is that the police chief thankfully lost his job. He was going to retire, but they went ahead and fired him. There was no particularized, nothing in the application for the no-knock warrant was particularized to this particular person. They said in their application that people who run drugs are notoriously able to dispose of them prior to the search. But the person they were looking for, the Glover, he didn't even live there. He had received a package, according to the postal inspector. There was a question of the postal inspector. Said, we didn't say that. Point I'm making is that if you pound on somebody's door late at night and her boyfriend had a permit to carry a weapon and you don't announce yourself as the police, what do you think is going to happen when you think someone's breaking in your house? That's the whole reason why we're so irritated at Cobb County. If you're going to knock at people's doors late at night, pounding with the police knock, and if you don't say police, of course, I would not want them saying police at 11:30 at night, but it's only a recipe for bad things to happen. You can't do that, folks. This woman died because the police were lazy. They used boilerplate language. The courts were lazy. They didn't review the warrant carefully, the application. A good judge would have said, I just read this. There's nothing particular about this where you've said there's any reason that you have particular to this suspect that would allow me to grant this no-doc warrant. Denied. But see, if you do that, if you're in a state where the police have the power to go out and campaign against you, in the states where you have to run for a judge, what would happen if you did that on a routine basis to the police? You would all of a sudden find your judicial career coming to an end because you're denying the police the opportunity to do their job, and you're siding with the criminals. So that's why judges are hesitant to say no to the police, particularly if they have to face the wrath of angry voters.
Well, Christian, is there anything that you want to hit before we shut it down?
I do want to say two things really quick on this. One, I wish they had a lot more publicity on that 77-year-old retired police officer in St. Louis that got beat up by the thugs. That should have had more publicity. And two, about 5-6 years ago, Hmong family, Minneapolis police, executed a warrant, wrong house, at Hmong, very little English, did shoot one of the officers as he was coming in. He wasn't charged. The Hennepin County prosecution, our prosecutors, decided not to charge him. So I wanted to share that.
Well, when you say the 77-year-old retired got beat up by the thugs, what thugs?
This was a police officer, Larry, 77, did 38 years in the St. Louis Police Department, Missouri, volunteering. And during this rioting, two thugs did beat him up and kill him. It made very, very little news, and I was really shocked about that.
Well, but aren't the thugs being prosecuted? Have they not apprehended them? I haven't heard the story, but would the...
Yes, they did. They did apprehend them, yeah.
But see, that's the whole point people miss. The reason why you don't hear a lot about something like that, and it's tragic and it's unfortunate, but they have been brought to justice. They are facing criminal charges. What we're angry about with these things is the police never get brought before the courts. And when they do, they're found not guilty. There's no accountability. Those people will be held accountable. And hopefully, if the evidence is there, they'll be convicted. But in the case of police misconduct, you can barely get a prosecutor to bring a case because they know what's going to be the outcome. They know that they're not likely to gain a conviction. They know that they're going to have the whole police department turn on them. And they know all the retaliation they're facing. Our district attorney here in Bernalillo County, when she charged the cops in the death, the one cop in the death of James Boyd, she said that she felt threatened for her life. Now, isn't that a sad thing when you're the prosecutor and you feel threatened by the police? She said that she felt for her safety. She feared for her safety.
Christian, thank you so much for go. Yeah. Please go ahead.
Oh no, I was going to agree with Larry. Absolutely. And continue, Andy. I'm sorry. I just wanted to say I agree with Larry. So.
Thank you so much for joining us. And I wanted to give you an opportunity to plug Minnesota 4. How can they find it? How can they reach out to you? Because I'm sure the 7 people that live in Minnesota, that I'm sure all of them listen to the podcast.
Well, hey, it may have shrunk here recently. So as I said before, I tracked down Brenda. Brenda's been wonderful. And I kind of miss Brenda. She was supposed to come in April. We were supposed to do Brenda, what was it called? Brenda, you're gonna have to help me here. What was the name? She's not the COVID issue. She's probably not. But what it is, guys, is Minnesota 4. It's mnfor.narsal@yahoo.com. So again, mnfor.narsal@yahoo.com. Excuse me. So yeah.
Okay.
Before we sign off, I want to make one correction. When we got the email about the one that I pontificated about earlier, about only because it's black people, as I was listening to something I said, I misspoke when I was talking about the 11th Circuit, the Florida, about the Florida appealing the judge's decision on the voting. And I said that judges on the 11th Circuit were appointed, that there was judges that DeSantis had appointed to the Florida court who are now on the 11th Circuit, appointed by Obama. I did not mean to say that. I was in my mind thinking Trump, but as I listened to my words, I said Obama. So that was not what I intended to say.
All right, then. So, Larry, we have to mark this day that you were wrong once, at least.
Well, it probably no telling how many times I misspeak. I just don't hear about it. I don't generally go back and listen to the podcast because it's bad enough I have to do it once. But I was making sure that I was in context because we got some feedback that we knew was taken out of context, and so I was going back to listening to make sure that I hadn't misspoken, and the context where the person was concerned about was just it was not the context of what we were talking about, and I don't think we want to go into it at the end of the podcast, but it was taken out of context.
All right, and then also Brenda, Larry, you can attest to this one that there is a pretty significant webcast that Narsil is putting on this coming weekend. And she wanted me to remind everyone, you'll get this, everyone will get this by Tuesday. So to remind you that Narsil is having their annual conference, it's being done remotely. And if you head over to narsil.org, you can find links on the page to sign up. It is not expensive. It's $35. It's over a couple days with pretty much all of the main speakers that were going to be there originally anyway. And I'll have a link in the show notes that will get you right there. But just head over to narsil.org, narsol.org. And you can find out how to register for the program. Larry, we can skip all the extra stuff. Everyone knows where to go. Go to registrymatters.co, and you can find all the show notes and links and phone numbers and all that stuff.
And the Narsil Live webcast is going to be fantastic. And I totally underestimated the interest in it. We have a record number of 200 signed up already to go. And I predicted that it would surprise me if we surpassed 100 when we were talking about this internally. I said, with the psyche of the nation being what it is and so many distractions, we'd be lucky if we have 100 people show up. Well, you know what? We've doubled that, and we still have a week to go.
Excellent. Well, that's all I got. Again, Christian, thank you for joining. Larry, thank you, and hopefully you'll make it to your appointment on time.
I think I will.
Go ahead.
I'm wondering if we should do a because we're trying to have a little structure in our after podcast banter, and I'm not going to be able to do one today, but I'd be willing to pop in tomorrow afternoon because I'm going to come to the office, but we could do a little bit banter for folks who want to either ask a question or make a comment. But tonight, unfortunately, I do have to bolt out of here as soon as we sign off.
Well, very good. We'll try and schedule that in there in the future.
So, all right, guys.
Appreciate you guys. Appreciate you having me on, and Larry's. Say hi to your fiance for me. So,
good night, everybody. Thanks everybody in chat, and thank you for keeping me company and keeping it interesting. And with that, I bid everybody adieu. Have a great night.
Thank you. Bye.